Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
You know, I think about Jim Collins' Good to Great, and he talks about this concept of just get the right people on the bus, right? People are going to shift seats and move around the bus. But that goes back to our earlier chat about purpose, right? You want people who are aligned to your organizational purpose, who share your values. You want those people on the bus with you, but the seats may change. And the speed of business is changing so quickly that there's no way someone's going to have the same role within the same bright lines for years upon years upon years. It's just things are changing too quickly. And so, you know, I think the creative leader is able to see that change and embrace it and help foster an environment that enables that change to happen in a really productive way.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Anne, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So you're actually back here for a second time. We had you in the past, and you have a new book out called Born to Create, all of which we will get into. And I was trying to think back to what I had asked you the last time, and I'm pretty sure I may have asked this question last time, but I also thought it would be relevant to talk about it again, given the subject matter of the book. And that is, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact did that end up having on where you've ended up with your life and your career?
Oh my goodness. Great question. Social group in high school. Well, it's interesting you asked that question because my high school is actually featured in the book. So there is some connection here. So I went to the LA County High School for the Arts, and my high school experience, probably perhaps different from most, was a highlight of my life. It was just such a dynamic, incredible, really life-shaping experience to be thrust in the midst of people from all parts of LA County, you know, just different walks of life, different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different talents, but all coming together to focus on developing our craft in the arts. And that really shaped how I view the world, to be honest. In terms of social group, I was probably a nerd artist. It was a highlight of my life though.
Well, so wait, in a school like that, you actually have the same sort of hierarchy of social groups that you do at an average high school, like cool kids, nerds?
Yeah, except there are no jocks, right? There were dancers. There's just such an interesting mix of people. That I think there's really a strong sense of belonging at LACSA. It's an audition-based school. It's actually the number one arts high school in the country.
Wow.
And it's just, it breeds a different type of human. People who are incredibly inclusive, incredibly curious, applying their creativity in new ways, and really solving academic problems through the arts. You know, we would put on a show about Black History Month, right? It was a Black History show. That was really influential. You know, we would, in chemistry, you know, you would actually dance, you know, do a dance to demonstrate how chemistry works. It's just a very different way of applying your creative thinking.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, so the curriculum of a school like this must be really different than, say, an average high school, like where you have a teacher lecturing in front of the room. So, like, how do you get all this? How do they get by all the you know, mandatory state requirements in an environment like this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a public school. So, yeah, they absolutely have the academic requirements. And we had our academics from like 8 to noon and then have lunch. And then our arts classes were from 1 to 4. So it wasn't as if we were skirting any kind of state requirements, like you said. But, you know, a lot of the academic teachers were former artists themselves. And so, you know, I'm thinking of my French teacher who was a dancer. She had a different way of accessing learning about France and learning the language than a typical French teacher would have. You know, she just had a different creative view of the world, which I think influenced how all of the students learned. So powerful.
Yeah. Well, I know you have kids, and I wonder, based on your own experience of going to LACSA, like, when you think about, you know, where the education system is at, the world that we're headed into and the experience that you had, what do you think needs to be integrated into the way that we're educating kids today that isn't currently there?
Yeah, I mean, probably of no great surprise, I'm a huge proponent of early arts education. I think having us view the world through that lens and accessing different ways of telling stories and empathizing with different human experiences is the future, right? That's how we access our creativity. It's how we solve the world's biggest problems. And I think that starts at an early age, ideally. You know, Chris Bowers, who also went to LACSA, is now a really well-known composer, kind of talked about this in a recent LA Times article where his early education in music really shaped how he views the world. And it's that kind of investment, hopefully publicly funded investment in our children's experiences that can really shape their future and how they choose to spend their time, you know, what careers they enter into. I am a parent. So yeah, I see it in my own kids. They're accessing different arts education really makes an impact on not only, you know, their well-being, but just really their energy towards other academic interests as well. So they feed each other.
Yeah. So I wonder, like, you know, when you look at your classmates, how many of them actually have gone on to have careers in the arts? And how in the world do you go from that to sort of doing the work that you do today, which is not exactly a 180, but kind of bringing all that, you know, insight, you know, forward to what you do?
Yeah. I mean, a lot, gosh, LACSA has a pretty impressive track record. You know, we've got, you know, Josh Groban and Anthony Anderson and, some of my classmates have really made it big in the visual arts world. Kehinde Wilde, who did a portrait of Obama. I mean, these are really well-known artists who came from that school, that high school. And I think, you know, we showcase, we put those people on pedestals, but there are just as many people who have become really well-known doctors and a lot of outstanding teachers. And so I think there's really a mix. Certainly not everyone went into the arts as their career and profession. You know, I did it for a while, as you recall, Srini. You know, I was a professional singer, actor, dancer, and then made a hard pivot to the business world. And I think now in the work that I do, it's really the blending of those experiences that differentiates what I do and hopefully makes a lasting impact with the clients that I serve.
Yeah. Well, I mean, walk me through the trajectory. And in terms of the pivot, I think one of the things that I often find, especially when I talk to people like professional athletes who end up retiring, is they have this thing that has been such an integral part of their identity for so long that they have to kind of reconcile that with what they choose to do going forward. I remember I had a professional violinist here who wrote a book on classical music, and she had been playing since she was 3. And she said, yeah, I basically just quit. I'm done. And I haven't picked it up in 2 years. And I thought to myself, I'm like, you know, how do you reconcile the identity in that kind of pivot?
Yeah, I think a lot about identity. It's really interesting that you're pulling on this thread. You know, I think whether it's a professional athlete, an artist, anyone who has that kind of focus, really intense focus and discipline, is going to have their identity connected to this craft, whatever it is, right? But I think it's so transferable. If you think about the ability to focus, to become an expert, to kind of break down a process. I think those are the skills that apply to lots of different disciplines, whether it's, you know, being a leader in a company or being a parent. You can kind of break things down and you develop that muscle for learning and for being curious and for focusing for long stretches. And so hopefully the pivot is something that you can get used to.
Yeah. Well, so talk to me about, you know, kind of what has led to this book, like why this book, why now, like what was the impetus for writing this?
Yeah. I mean, I had observed for a long time that organizational cultures thrive when people are given the freedom to create and when they can come up with their own ideas, when they can experiment, learn from their failures. I mean, those are really the environments that lead to a more engaged, happier workforce. And it also leads to better business results. So I'd kind of been tracking that over the years of being a service provider, seeing lots of different corporate environments. I mean, hundreds of corporate environments. And I kind of had this light bulb moment that all of the creative stuff that I had been working on as an artist absolutely translated and applied to the business world. And so, you know, fast forward, here we are in the global pandemic. People are needing to reinvent how they work together. You know, they're in these distributed teams. How do you connect? How do you innovate when you have these creative constraints? And I thought, gosh, I would love to share and connect the dots for more people to have a more, you know, creative work environment and really feel like they can thrive in their professional lives and their personal lives. So that was the impetus.
Yeah. Well, one of the earliest things you say in the book is the big missing realization is that creativity is accessible to each of us, as we'll discover the value in expressing our creativity shows just why it's so crucial for us to learn, even if we are rocket scientists. And then you go on to say that creativity is what moves us from the stale, worn out status quo to novel, useful, and unexpected solutions. I think the notion that it's accessible to all of us is where a lot of people kind of get stuck. Like there's this sort of narrative of like, oh, I'm creative or I'm not. You know, we kind of make it a trait rather than a skill. Talk to me about how you begin to shift that narrative at the individual level and then at an organizational level as well.
Yeah. I mean, you're spot on, Srini. It's really interesting. When I was starting my company, Spring Street, and I would talk to organizational leaders about creativity and the importance of it in the workplace, I bumped up against a lot of resistance. A lot of people who thought, no, you know, we don't want to be creative, or I don't see myself as creative. And that was really intriguing to me, that people would have such a strong visceral reaction to even the word creative, as if they didn't want to go near that and it would discredit them. But then I started to kind of peel the onion. And, you know, the truth is people enjoy expressing themselves. They enjoy bringing their ideas forward. They enjoy the process of solving a complex problem. And if we can redefine what creativity means and how it's applied, people understand the real value of it. And they see, not only does it feel good, but it leads to really good results in their teams. And so it's through that process of really meeting that resistance that I thought, huh, we need to almost reframe in our own mind what creative means. And you know, once we do that reset, then it feels a lot more accessible to people.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the other thing is, you know, thinking about how we integrate it into sort of a standard working environment, right? Because not all of us have the you know, fortune to work at Google where you have this 20% time. So I, you know, to your point, you probably face some resistance. Like, one, how do you get buy-in that this is actually a worthwhile pursuit and then, you know, tie it to actual business results? Because I could see the argument that, hey, you know, like, we don't want you to be creative. You're here to produce results.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I hope that that point lands in the book, that we're not talking about creativity for creativity's sake. We're talking about being creative with the purpose to yield the results you want to yield. And, you know, someone's funding this creativity. You kind of have to deliver at some point. And so, if you have that as the backdrop, you know, I found companies recognize, yeah, we do need to experiment. We do need to, you know, reinvent our business in this new world of work. And with that recognition, with that shared desire to innovate and do things differently, then there's a much better appetite towards, okay, let's get into the how. How do we do this? How do we shift the mindset and really set up structures to support a creative work environment?
Yeah. What about the role of curiosity in all of this? Because it seems like it's an integral part of it. I mean, I can tell you this. I've built a career by doing nothing but following my curiosity. And I felt that that has, you know, I feel like one of the challenges even with our whole education system is it drills the curiosity out of us, because eventually we just become so concerned with, you know, getting good grades. It's like, I need to just follow the damn rules. And in that process, I think we lose that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think there is this tension of wanting to create repeatable processes in business. And I get that. You know, you need to have an efficient work environment. You need to be clear about who's doing what and when. All those things are important. But I think creating that space with constraints, right, with limits, you're not going to just kind of brainstorm all day long. That wouldn't make sense. But when you structure an environment where everyone is encouraged to think about and get curious about the problem and really sit with the problem and empathize and think about different perspectives, that's when you start to see real step change in terms of producing a better product or service. And It's when we get so rigid in our approach and we over-engineer all the creativity out of the system, people don't have the space to be curious because it's been engineered out.
Yeah.
So that's really what I focus on.
Well, so, you know, as it relates to that, one of the things you say is that Roger Beatty, professor at Penn State University and leader of the cognitive neuroscience of Creativity Lab, has done extensive research on creativity in our brains. And his research reveals that allowing our minds to wander and activating our imaginations are powerful tools to kickstart our brain's networks to produce more creative thoughts. It's the strength of our brain's connection between the default control and salience networks that serves as a strong predictor of creativity. So, talk to me about that. Like, well, let's take that and make it practical.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's been a lot of research, and Beatty kind of leads this effort in the connection between memory and imagination, kind of, you know, remembering what's been done, what you've experienced in the past, and then connecting that to future ideas. And so it can be a really powerful tool to get detailed about specific memories as a vehicle for accessing what's possible in the future. And so I think when you describe all those different networks in our brain, that's really what we're talking about. We're toggling among the processing of the now, reflecting and thinking about details of the past, and then using that to fuel our imagination for what's possible in the future.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things I wonder about is the role that knowledge acquisition plays in all of this, because I think, you know, as I was alluding to earlier before we hit record, one of the great things for somebody like me with AI is the sheer volume of information that I have just kind of accumulated that is actually useful, like podcast transcripts, you know, articles, whatever it is, notes from all the books I've read. So how does that tie into this concept of, you know, this idea of letting our imaginations wander? Because I feel like it has to have a profound influence.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're describing, where my brain leaps, is the ability to process big data in ways that we've never been able to do before can help us build new connections and help us spot trends that maybe our monkey brains can't yet do. And so by engaging technology to help synthesize all of that data that you just described, we can then have an output that, this is a trend. Like this is bubbling up, and we can use that to fuel even new ideas. So I think, again, it's in the processing that, that we're not able to do, but that tech can have a great assist in accessing those, you know, trending data lines.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the process of building creative confidence, because I know you alluded to it. And it's amazing to me. I'll tell you, like, I remember we did an audience survey. One of the things when we asked people, like, what is the major thing that is keeping you from doing this creative thing that you say you want to do? Fear of public opinion was at the top of the list. Like, I came across that so many times. And, you know, like, I remember thinking, I was like, you know what? Like, no matter what you do that's creative, when you start, you're going to suck. That's just part of the deal. That's kind of any new skill that you're going to learn.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. You're going to suck for a while. And then it gets better, and then you're kind of used to sucking. And so it doesn't feel as bad. there's probably a real, mappable stages of grief as it comes to creative output and generating new stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think it does start with confidence. It comes with a lot of practice and a lot of getting out of your comfort zone. And then that kind of expands your ability to, okay, I've dealt with this discomfort. Let me try the next uncomfortable thing. So I think the more that we can encourage that in the workplace, obviously safely and in a way that supports people, I think that develops more of our creative muscle.
Well, I mean, I think that you make a point. You just said, you know, sort of that next uncomfortable thing. I think the harder thing is getting people to do that very first uncomfortable thing, like taking that first step. It's mind boggling to me how paralyzed people are, because I will have people, I remember, you know, years ago, some girl at a bar came to some event and she was asking me question after question about starting a podcast. And I was like, honestly, I don't know any of the answers to any of these questions because they're all basically based on speculation. I'm like, you have to go out and do something to actually figure out some of the answers to these questions. Like, I started mapping out this idea for a blog post. I was like, there's literally no substitute for knowledge that's gained through experience.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It's all about, hey, let's improv, let's put it on its feet. And when you take those small little risks, and what you just described is, hey, maybe it feels like a big risk in your mind, but you do have to experience it. And yes, you may fall flat and you'll learn from it. But I think, yeah, that initial first step can be really hard for some of us. And creating is a very vulnerable act. It's not for the faint of heart. And you kind of have to prepare yourself for that failure and then move through it. And then you're ready for the next time.
Well, one of the other things you say here is that knowing our purpose at work is an increasingly important component to feeling engaged beyond a paycheck. What do I get out of my working experience? And I think that purpose is one of those things that feels really nebulous, very hard to kind of comprehend. And, you know, people come to work, the work of somebody like Simon Sinek, and think, okay, I'm just going to sit down, I'm going to read this book, and then I'm going to know why I'm doing what I'm doing. And, you know, having interviewed Simon Sinek and then gone through the experience, when he told me, he's like, you're obsessed with people that are good at unusual things. That's your why. And thinking, that's great. That's completely useless. What do I do with that? only to realize 10 years later that was spot on. Talk to me about this process of figuring out, you know, sort of this intersection of, you know, talent, demand, and, you know, love, basically. Because I think that is often one of the things that trips so many creative people up. Either they're good at something that nobody is ever going to pay them for. They are terrible at something and they hope to get good at it, where there's really no shot that they will. I think it's just, purpose is, in my mind, one of those things. If somebody had talked to me about purpose when I was 21, I would have been like, this sounds like a bunch of new age nonsense.
Totally. Yeah, it's a little woo-woo. But, you know, I think what you're describing, Srini, with the ikigai, right? It's that Japanese philosophy of the intersection of all these components. It takes some work, right? It takes a lot of maybe journaling, a lot of asking questions, a lot of getting curious with yourself and your own intentions, a lot of looking in the mirror and being honest with, hey, what am I really good at? And what what would people pay for? So, you know, sometimes we don't like the answers to those questions that we ask ourselves. And I think it takes that level of curiosity and that level of getting real that can lead to a real and true purpose and ikigai.
Well, let's talk briefly about time management, because this is one of the parts of the book that I highlighted, and I dumped it into an AI tool and was like, okay, figure out how to plan my day according to this. You say that many of us blindly go through our workday without much attention to how we're spending our time. In this exercise, think about how you would be optimally spending your time while you're working, and you break it up into deep work, admin, collaboration, and process work. Can you expand on that for me and tell me how you yourself apply this to planning your days? Like, what does your average day look like when you look at it through this lens?
It's, gosh, I think a lot about this, and a lot of my clients struggle with this big question. How should I be spending my time? What is the highest and best use of my time on a given day? And it's going to vary, right? Not every day is going to be the same. You're going to have fires to put out. That's a given. But I think by designing, and this kind of goes to more design thinking principles of what would the ideal outcome look like if I were to start from scratch and really have a blank slate, design it the way that fuels me. Where do I find fulfillment? Where do I see that I'm making the biggest impact? And how can I ensure that I'm protecting that time? So the deep work is a great example. Really want to make sure that we have a space. I'm speaking personally, a space in my day where I can do some deep work and, you know, limit the distractions, really dive in, get into my flow state. And that's where I feel really energized and fulfilled. So, you know, we don't want to craft our days based on all of the fire drills, just what's the urgent. We want to carve out time for the important. So that's a little bit about how I shape things.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds to me like what you're doing is batching this type of work together, right? Like collaboration, deep work, and then process work, like admin work. I finally realized like admin work was one of those things that, you know, I needed a process for it. And it was like, okay, this is the thing I hate doing the most. And I tend to be really bad about dealing with it. but in general, I was like, okay, you know what? I think that we just do like set aside an admin block, you know, whether it's every day or every other day. It's kind of amazing because I think one of the things I see over and over is that administrative work gets, you know, sort of mistaken for work. Like we kind of confuse busy and productive.
Yes, for sure. And I think, you know, there are some hacks to this, right? Pomodoro technique, setting your timer for 25 minutes and then giving yourself a 5-minute break, right? One Pomodoro. I actually shared that with my daughter and she's really into it, right? She's 9 and spends these Pomodoros. She thinks it's hilarious, but, you know, really, okay, I'm going to read for 25 minutes, take a break, and then, you know, do something else for 25 minutes. And it's in those rewiring of our time allocation that can really lead to more productivity and more fulfillment too. It's not just about producing. It's about feeling like our work really matters.
Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, speaking of feeling like our work really matters, let's talk about feedback, because feedback is this, like, you know, I can't think of anything that makes people cringe more, yet is more valuable. You say it's easy to get wrapped around the axle when it comes to evaluating ourselves. Anticipating feedback from others can be stressful. A person's feedback is simply that, one perspective full of bias and subjectivity. Unsolicited feedback can easily put us on the defensive. Seeking out feedback, on the other hand, primes us to learn. It's more brain friendly. We can take it in and put it in its proper place, hopefully tear free. And I think that I'd be really curious. I mean, you've just finished writing a book. And you and I both know that this process is not without feedback. And some of that feedback is absolutely brutal at times. Like, I, I hired the toughest writing coach ever. And in two books that she worked with me on, the closest I got to a compliment was good. And and honestly, I would hire her again. She made me a much better writer. It took me a long, it took me a month to stop taking her feedback personally. Like that, and the funny thing is, I was like, wait a minute, I'm paying her a lot of money to give me this feedback. You know, I probably need to like stop, listen, you know, take it, like not take it personally. But I think this is for creative people, this is one of the most challenging things to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm so glad you highlighted this. It's so difficult for most of us to take feedback for what it is and really apply it and use it and integrate it. And also not take it personally. Like you said, you know, in the book, I talk about taking the note. And as a young actor, I vividly remember sitting in the house seats after a performance and, you know, the director will sit on the lap of the stage or, you know, that little apron and give out notes. And it was just part of the process. And here you have these experienced, well-known actors sitting in the house and taking the feedback, right? They take the note. And that skill was kind of burned into my brain at a really young age. And not to say that feedback didn't wound me and still does, but, I think it's that discipline and that distance from it. Like, hey, this person is here to help me. We all want a great production. I didn't have a flawless performance, and that's okay. We can learn from it. And that's a muscle to build.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there's anything that I had ever kind of come to the conclusion on feedback, you know, just based on the last 10 or 13 years, is that so often what you want to hear feels good, but what you need to hear is actually good. And it doesn't feel good in the moment, but it usually ends up being, you know, tremendously beneficial down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. How else are you going to grow, right? How else are you going to change and get better? If you don't have those pieces of feedback, and sometimes that's self feedback, you know, it's important to reflect.
Yeah. I mean, you break this up into different feedback groups, you know, peer feedback, manager feedback, and, you know, self feedback, and then connecting that. So talk to me about how, one, you seek feedback that is useful, do it without getting defensive, and then integrate it into, you know, your life and your work.
Yeah. Yeah, I do believe in the power of asking for feedback. Like I say, it is more brain friendly, but I also think it needs to be specific. So it's not just, oh, how was that? You know, that's, you're not going to get a lot of results that way. But if you say, hey, I'm really working on my tone and I'd really love you to give me some feedback after this presentation and really focus on my tone. Did it land? So that could be a really specific ask that you have of someone. You're kind of priming the pump. You're readying your own brain for getting that feedback. And so that feels, better for us, but you're also being really specific of the feedback giver. And so they're not just boiling the ocean and saying, everything, but they're being specific.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the other thing is also who you solicit feedback from, because I think that, you know, not all feedback is created equal. Like I remember during the book writing process, I'm like, okay, the people whose feedback matters right now are my editor and my agent and my writing. That is it. Like because I mean, the thing is, I think that if there's anything that will, you know, fuel your insecurity more than any, like there's nothing that will fuel your insecurity more when you're not other than going and reading your Amazon. That is like the worst idea ever. Seth Godin doesn't read his book reviews. I was like, if Seth doesn't read his book reviews, and he made a really interesting observation in one of his, seminars that he did called Leap First. It's like an audiobook. And he said, I've never met a writer who said, you know what? I've read all the 1-star reviews of my book. I've taken the feedback to heart, incorporated it into my work, and I'm a better writer now.
Yeah, you're so right. Know your audience, right? You're right. Not all feedback is created equal. And you kind of have to look for trends. You know, is it an outlier? Is this just kind of a one-off? Someone is disgruntled about something? Or is there a real trend and pattern here? You know, going back to AI, I think that that can be powerful. What are the key themes from all this feedback? Maybe you just, you look away and you just copy and paste and you feed it to AI and say, okay, what are the key themes that I should take away from this? So, I think there are different ways of processing it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's shift gears a bit and talk about this notion of creative leadership, because you say creative leaders value each person's unique perspective and humanness. They bring out the best in their people, and in return, their employees just seem more satisfied with their work and lives. creative leadership is what lit a spark within. And I think that this is severely lacking in my, based on my, you know, sort of horrendous experience with corporate world. Because one of the things that I see, my experience with all of this was that there's this constant, like, sort of mismatch between talent and environment. And so when you have poor performance, the default is let's put this person on a performance improvement plan. That way, when we fire them, we'll avoid a wrongful termination suit. They don't stop to do is say, wait a minute, is this person even in the right job?
Yeah. And I'm really glad that you raised that. You know, I think about Jim Collins, Good to Great, and he talks about this concept of just get the right people on the bus, right? People are going to shift seats and move around the bus. But that goes back to our earlier chat about purpose, right? You want people who are aligned to your organizational purpose, who share your values. You want those people on the bus with you, but the seats may change. And the speed of business is changing so quickly that there's no way someone's going to have the same role within the same bright lines for years upon years upon years. It's just things are changing too quickly. And so, you know, I think the creative leader is able to see that change and embrace it and help foster an environment that enables that change to happen in a really productive way.
Yeah. Well, speaking of environments, you talk quite a bit about this. It's funny. We had a guy named Jim Bunch who, we had an episode, it was probably one of our most popular episodes ever, called The Nine Environments That Make Up Your Life, and how every aspect of your life is an environment that shapes, you know, your behavior, your outcomes, your attitude. And it was pretty mind-boggling to me, like, how effective that simple idea was. I mean, he basically was talking about the life-changing magic of tidying up. Marie Kondo just did a much better job packaging that idea. You brought it up in terms of the workplaces, because I can tell you, I remember when I would go to a job interview, there are times when I would walk into the office and immediately I would be like, I know I don't want to work here, just from walking in the door.
Yeah. You can feel it, right? Yeah. It's like spidey senses. Yeah. Yeah. And I think not every environment is for everyone, and being okay with that, being confident in your own sense of values and shaping the kind of environment where you know you can thrive. It really helps to know that going in, so that you're not just leaving it to chance and hoping for the best, but that ideally you're really finding a mutual fit before you commit to a place to work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that applies to our home environments too, right? Like, it, in my mind, it's like, because I work from home, it's like, okay, this environment needs to be optimized for my own creativity and my own deep work in so many ways. And so many of us actually, I think we don't really understand just how impactful that is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I talk a lot about officing like a set designer, right? Drawing from my experiences in the theater, and you're shaping these different worlds, these different environments. And the set designer is being extremely specific in where does this chair go, or, how are we going to light this particular area of the stage? I mean, that's what shapes the experience for the audience and for the people on the stage. And we can do the same thing in our own lives.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what you call creativity gatekeepers. You say that after new ideas are generated, the next challenge for the creative leader is to help prioritize and evaluate them. This often involves inviting new stakeholders to the working team, enter stage left, the creativity gatekeepers. So give me a concrete example of a creativity gatekeeper. Like, what does that actually look like in an organization? Yeah. And how do people either, ignore, bypass, or collaborate with a gatekeeper?
Yeah. It's funny because a lot of times, creativity gatekeepers, they have the idea that they are, they're of service to the people giving them ideas. But a lot of times, really creative, off the wall ideas, by their very nature, are going to be dismissed because they look foreign and they seem so different that, our brains leap to the conclusion that there's no way this will work. Because it's so foreign and uncomfortable and new. And so a really effective creativity gatekeeper has the capacity to envision the way it will work. Not to say that it will, but they can at least envision the path. And so I think for someone at an organization, maybe it's the team leader who's going to be the gatekeeper. Finding a way to build collaboratively so that the idea is shared. And so you're constantly connecting to the value and the possible way that this will work. It really takes that kind of collaboration and and teamwork for an idea to take flight.
Yeah. Well, so you get from that to prioritization, and it's kind of funny. This is the second time I've come across this idea this week where you say ruthlessly prioritize. A boss of mine once shared there's no such thing as 10 priorities. If everything's a priority, then nothing is a priority. Look at your to-do list and circle 2 to 3 key things that must get done. So, you know, I had to, Google sort of chief, you know, productivity expert here yesterday. I was just talking to her. She has a new book coming out called Uptime. And this rule of three came up, and this is the second time I've seen it. And so I'm wondering, like, when you say, you know, prioritize, like, what does that look like when we look at it day to day and connect it to, you know, what we want to accomplish over the long term?
Yeah. Well, I think I work with a lot of entrepreneurs. I work with a lot of founders and people who are tackling really new, novel, complex issues. And no day is the same, right? It's having the ability to be in the moment, to understand all of the different factors at play, be a systems thinker, right? What are the ramifications if I make this decision? Those folks are very effective at ruthless prioritization. And that means that a project that was super urgent and the most important thing yesterday may not be the same today. And it's a discipline. It's a muscle. And I think that in today's environment with things changing so quickly, we all need to do that in our personal and professional lives.
Yeah. So now let's take this and make it sort of more tactical. You know, we've been talking sort of at a high level, but I think this was one of those things that really interested me. You said, you know, when you're talking about Jeff, you know, we go from sort of this idea to collaboration, to creativity, to the final output. And then we get to marketing and communication messages to reflect company culture. But I think this, when I saw this, I thought, okay, you know what? This is equally relevant to an individual creator as it is to an organization. So you talk about sort of the North Star audiences, communication channels. Can you expand on this for me and explain it like step by step?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of steps in the book when it comes to, okay, you've got your creative output, then what, right? If no one knows about your idea, if no one connects to the idea, it's still going to fail, even if it's the best idea. And so I think that comes down to connecting the dots with what's in it for me and building the story around it. And you're right, Srini. This could be an individual content creator, or this could be, you know, the head of a large global organization. Still needs the message to land, still needs the idea to connect with each individual audience member or customer. So building that story and making sure that you're clear and consistent and that it's a compelling message is such a crucial stage in any creator's life. And, you know, arguably maybe the most critical.
So, I mean, you talk about defining the different audiences, communication channels, the timeline, consistency or impact gaps. So one, I think the timeline thing is pretty straightforward. Communication channels, that should be kind of self-explanatory to most people. It's like, I'm a podcaster. My communication channel is audio. But I think the other one was creating ongoing measurement. You say that we measure what matters when it comes to your North Star or purpose for your organization. If you're not making the effort to gain data and insights on how your message is landing, it becomes difficult to make refinements when things aren't working. And
yeah,
you know, Kel Newport once said to me that metrics are this double-edged sword, because he said that one of the greatest things he did for himself was not to look at his book sale numbers on the author portal. Like, he never bothered to log in or look at it. And I realized that was an exercise in futility, because there's sort of, again, like, we have to find this balance between learning how to use this insight without letting it sort of, you know, derail us, because metrics can be really depressing when you look at them sometimes.
Yeah, they can be the tail that wags the dog. I totally agree. And I think, oh, I'm so glad that you mentioned this, because metrics are just a point in time. They're a snapshot in time. And I think you kind of have to have that a grain of salt mentality when it comes to metrics. Yes, they're important, and you kind of need to know those trending lines for sure, but they're a snapshot, and they are one star in the constellation of things that you should be thinking about and caring about. And a lot of times when we double down, when we only care about the metrics, we can make really dumb decisions because we're not really looking at the whole picture. Yeah. We're not hearing about the experiences that are more qualitative. And so I think it's really the combination of those that lead to great results.
Yeah. I mean, I've found in my experience that almost always, like, if I try to replicate something that did really well, it falls flat. If I start with the end in mind of the number, with the metrics, as opposed to the thing I want to create, it falls flat. And I think that's one of the strange paradoxes of creative work, is that, like, the less you concern yourself with metrics and more you focus on the process, the better the metrics end up being.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? It makes me think of Bob Reynolds, who I also feature in the book, is a saxophone player, and he has a thriving business and he sends these amazing marketing messages, but no two are the same, right? It's a constant experiment. And so I think it's in that that curiosity and embracing the experimentation of business building, whatever your business is, that leads to the best results. Mm-hmm. And you hopefully start to see patterns, but you got to keep experimenting.
Yeah. Well, talk to me about the actual tangible results that have resulted from people embracing this, because I think, you know, like you said, you faced a lot of resistance from people at the beginning. So what are the actual business results? Like, how do you tie all of this together to tangible outcomes, both on an organizational and an individual level?
Yeah, I mean, without disclosing any confidential information, I've seen great results in my clients when they apply these principles, greater creative output in the form of innovative ideas that are actually meeting customer demand, greater workplace culture metrics in terms of levels of happiness and engagement. So we know that this stuff works. We know that more creativity in the workplace does lead to stronger organizational mattering and productivity. And there are plenty of studies that will point to that. But it's not something that's just, okay, check the box, we did it, we're done. Unfortunately, this is kind of a lifelong practice. You have to continuously apply the learning and tinker with it and commit to it. And so it's unfortunately or fortunately an evergreen challenge for organizations.
Yeah, I think that part of the reason that even I have had such a hard time trying to make this case that you're making is I always feel like, okay, if you're talking to an organization, they want to see you quantify this in some way. You know, it's like, how do I quantify the ROI of letting people express their creativity at work?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think sometimes surveys can be a great tool for quantification. Sometimes revenue is a great form of quantification. You know, I think we're not operating in a vacuum. So everything is interdependent now. We feed on each other to create great results for the customers and clients that we serve. And, if we apply our creativity to continuously reinvent and get better and continuously improve, those are the skills that really lead to better outcomes for the business.
Well, let's talk specifically about the future of work, because towards the end of the book, you say cultivating creativity as a core skill and cultural characteristic has never been more important, more urgent. As more technology enters our workspaces, we'll soon be called to apply our human creativity in novel forms. We'll need to inspire and engage our workforce in new ways, redesign processes and workflows, and experiment with different tools. So from this perspective, like, paint a picture of the future of work.
Where's my crystal ball, right? I think we know that things are changing at an unprecedented rate. And that makes a lot of us uncomfortable. Change is hard. Change initiatives usually fail. I think latest data that I saw was, 50 to 70% of organizational change initiatives fall flat. They don't work. And so our creativity, because we know our businesses are going to look different 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we need to get creative. We need to embrace and lean into the process of reinventing what the future is going to look like. So, your question about what is the future of work look like? I think it is focusing more on people and our human experiences in combination with embracing new technology tools. It's really in that, the combining of those two efforts is going to lead to better results.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote this like mega article about what I called the four keys to success in the age of AI. And I basically said the irony of all of this is that almost none of these skills have anything to do with AI. In fact, the most important skills are the things that make us uniquely human.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I'll tell you, having kids and observing how they move through the world in a very different way, these are going to be sought after skills in the workplace. The ability to connect, the ability to be self-aware, to empathize, to tell a really compelling story. I mean, those are kind of the magic power skills, I call them, that are going to lead to better leaders and organizations that thrive. So how do we cultivate that at an early age and allow our kids the freedom to play and invent and collaborate without the constraints, without getting stuck to a screen? That's what I'd love to see.
Well, one of the final things you say in the book is that innovative cultures are built from the ground up. They're formed when people set the expectation to challenge the status quo because it's the cultural norm. Mm-hmm. When you're somebody who challenges the status quo in an organization, you can be seen in one of two ways: as somebody who is a pain in the ass or as somebody who moves this place forward. And I feel like more often than not, it's the former. And so, you know, the thing is, I think that there are plenty of people who want to challenge the status quo. I mean, I'll give you the stupidest example. You know, I worked at this online travel company for my first year out of business school. And every Monday we'd have this meeting, and I was like, it would just go on and on and on. And I'm like, this meeting is kind of unnecessary. It doesn't need to be this long. And I remember when I called in, you know, my hours got reduced. I called in from Costa Rica to sit in on the meeting. And I was like, these guys just spent 45 minutes. This, the CEO, the VP of marketing, and two developers discussing the broken air conditioner in the office. But the thing is that if you're the person who speaks up, you know, and says, okay, this is a terrible way to do things. And I'll give you another example. So when I was doing a lot of public speaking, one of the most frequent places I would get invited to were, you know, events for event planners. And I would basically rail against the hotel ballrooms and say, look, like nobody should be here because, you know, point of this isn't to trap people in, you know, ballrooms for 8 hours on end. Everybody would be thrilled. Event planners that would be at those events would hire me to speak in hotel ballrooms at their next event.
Yeah. Yeah. These are great examples, Srini. I mean, I think where my head goes is it's the tone at the top, right? If the leader is actually hosting a meeting and leaving 15 minutes at the end to say, okay, we've just shared a lot. Now poke holes in the idea, right? I want to hear from you. It's kind of inviting in that dissent. That can be really constructive and powerful. You're right. You're probably not going to be the most popular person on the team if you're criticizing your boss or criticizing, you know, how things are run. And yet, if the leader is inviting it actively, it kind of goes back to that feedback, right? They're priming the pump for, okay, I might hear things that I don't want to hear that might be bruising my ego a little bit, but I'm going to invite that because that's part of our culture. And so if that becomes a cultural norm, saying, hey, this is a really dumb meeting. We should talked about the broken air conditioner for 45 minutes. People would laugh and they would expect it. It would be part of the social norm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you brought up ego because that was the first thing I thought when you said that is that it has to come from the top down. And, you know, like a leader who has a fragile ego is not going to want the challenge to the status quo.
Absolutely not. No, it's threatening. So, you know, ego is a big, big part of this, a big part of, you know, I mean, a healthy ego, of course, is important, but, putting it in its proper place is important for creative leadership.
Wow. Well, this has been fantastic. You have just packed it with so many different insights. So I want to finish with my final question, which I know I've asked you before, and it's always interesting to see how people answer this question when they come back. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
You know, I thought about this, Srini, and I think to me, someone unmistakable is authentic and real. And I know people use the word authentic. It's kind of an overused word now. But that being able to be real, warts and all, and showing our imperfections and working on them and being human, that authenticity, I think, is what the world needs. Yeah.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and sharing your story and wisdom and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, the book, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
For sure. You can check out my website, which is springstreetco.com. You can find me on LinkedIn at LinkedIn/in/AnnJacoby or on Instagram, which is AnnJacoby.author.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.